This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Ross Chambliss and I are in the studio together for the first time in nearly a year of producing The Source together.
You know, behind every hour of The Source, there's probably, I don't know, how many hours we call, you know, left on the cutting room floor, basically. Mm-hmm. This is an old metaphor from when there used to actually be tape that people would actually cut, which luckily I wasn't in radio at that time because it sounds incredibly tedious. But but that does mean that my hard drive is full of files that didn't get used. I feel like it's probably like icebergs, you know? It's like 10% is on the surface and the rest of it is all sort of lurking below.
Right.
We did a lot of reporting. I spent a lot of time out there talking to people and doing things. And I wanted to give the chance for maybe some of those stories to see the light of day and get swept up off the cutting room floor. Was there anything that you sort of didn't get to tell or had to get cut, didn't have time? Like,
sure, certainly. I can think of a few examples, actually, that from this past year where reporting on some stories for The Source, that there was just a few details that I, you know, I was thinking about later after the story finally got mixed and it aired, and you know, even after a day or so, I'd be like, oh, I wish I had left that detail in there somehow, because I thought it would be interesting for listeners. One example, and I'll just sort of back up. You know, a few months back, we did a program on invasive species, invasive water species of various types, and I went out to tell a story about Phragmites. It's this sort of invasive weed that grows 10 to 12 feet high and just crowds out native plants, and it's really sort of taken over the Great Salt Lake ecosystem and parts of Utah Lake. I went out to do an interview or get some tape from there. I guess the Nature Conservancy manages a section of Great Salt Lake, and they had purchased this new big machine. They called it a Marshmaster, and it's designed to be just this sort of mega lawnmower that goes out and cuts down all these Phragmites, and it sprays herbicide. And it just looks like a big tank. And went out there, and there was just kind of a mob of other reporters out there that had gotten the same press release, and they wanted to tell the same story. And the guy that was kind of showing off the Marshmaster talked about, you know, what the machine does and why it's important to get rid of these plants and these invasive weeds. And then, you know, I got to ride on the Marshmaster, and I got some great photos and some great sound, and it was kind of, you know, it was a lot of fun. But the whole time, you know, at the end of the day, I thought just the whole event was really silly because all these reporters went back and told the same story, and I felt like that really wasn't the end of the story. I mean, the story was much bigger. So I was thinking, how can I tell this story in a more lively way, in a way that no one else is trying to tell this story? And I was thinking, you know, maybe if I could find some old film that kind of is an invasion film, you know, kind of a monster film, because, you know, maybe we can compare these invasive Phragmites to a monster. And I was kind of going back into my childhood, and I remember the 1984 Steven Spielberg film Gremlins, which at the time I was probably 6 or 7, and I found that film to be really disturbing. And it's an invasion film. You have these little creatures that come into a community and they raise hell. And I thought, well, let's go for it. And so I talked to Karin Kettenring. She's a professor of wetland ecology at Utah State University. And she just kind of described what she's learned about this plant and all the research she's doing to try to make them, you know, to contain them. And I decided to take certain films and excerpts from that film, from the movie Gremlins, and sort of overlap it and kind of try to tell the same story or a similar story to what these Phragmites are doing to the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, similar to what the Gremlins did to this, you know, the poor people in this small town in the movie. But the one thing that I thought that I could have gone further if I had tried, and that was to tell listeners that there actually is a native Phragmites that exists in Utah. Mostly, actually, it lives in southern Utah. It's called Phragmites australis subspecies americanus. And the subspecies of Phragmites, which the invasive form actually came from Europe and then kind of came across the east coast of the United States. This native form has been here for a lot longer and has just learned to adapt better. And it doesn't crowd out the native plants, the other native plants where it lives. And I was just thinking, if we're going to continue with this sort of comparison with gremlins, then I would say that this native subspecies of Phragmites, we would call it the Mogwai.
What is it?
Mogwai.
What's he doing?
Singing.
Because if you're familiar with the movie, Mogwai is the little furry, cute creature. This little furry guy doesn't terrorize people and is contained. And so, you know, I it's funny how, you know, you tell these stories and you're like, oh, I wish I had maybe mentioned that too, or that would have been a better way to continue with the analogy. But anyway.
Well, and I thought, I mean, the gremlins metaphor actually, I mean, worked really, really well. And I do think something that we did leave out of the whole invasive species episode was about native species. You know, invasive is a relative term, right? Mm-hmm. All of these plants are native to somewhere else. And so to just say Phragmites isn't really fair because mm-hmm. there are tons of different kinds of Phragmites.
Right,
and there's
types.
Only one. And of course, we don't want to say the Latin name every single time that we mention it. So we use the word Phragmites as a sort of stand-in for the invasive form. You know, we get so excited about talking about the invasives and we sort of demonize them. And I think the gremlins, of course, helped to demonize, to sort of put an ugly face on it. And
it did.
To be fair, we have to sort of back up and talk about how ecology works and how, you know, invasive is a relative term.
Absolutely. And I'll just mention it was Halloween, too.
That's
this.
Right.
It was part of a Halloween theme. While we're talking about stories from the past year, for you, what was perhaps one of your favorite field trips or maybe your most surprising?
Definitely the Walmart beaver story. Ross did some hiking and got to wear waders for his beaver story. My beaver assignment was a little less adventurous.
Really good quality beaver habitat for, you know, thousands of years.
There's like five grocery carts.
I head to the wetlands in the Walmart parking lot.
So the South Walmart in Logan had a beaver problem, and they were trapping and killing beavers, and they'd done it several times because the beaver dam was flooding the parking lot and it was causing a problem.
So I started talking to the person behind that booth, and it was Cammy from Walmart.
This is Dan Miller of the Bear River Watershed Council explaining to me last spring how he caught wind of the Walmart beaver problem.
She's talking about beaver, and she goes, well, you know, I'm kind of sad because we have beaver on our property and the previous manager hired trappers to come in and kill them. And my jaw just dropped. It's like, what?
Cammy Hipwell is the store manager at the South Logan Walmart Supercenter. A small tributary of the Logan River called Spring Creek runs through the parking lot of Cammy's store, and there's essentially an untouched little wetland area in the corner of what can only be described as the most un-wetland place on Earth. And it's home to a thriving beaver pond complex.
I had been studying and reading up on beaver and how they benefit watersheds, and so I knew there were different ways to deal with beaver. And I told Cammy this. I go, there's better ways. You don't have to be exterminating them.
And Dan Miller knew who to call. A team of researchers at Utah State University's Department of Watershed Sciences who specialize in helping people and companies like Walmart live with beaver.
My name's Elijah Portugal, and I'm a geomorphologist with the Fluvial Habitat Center at Utah State University. And I do a variety of work mostly related to beaver. So we, you know, design, plan, and implement beaver-assisted restoration projects.
I actually have an update on the Walmart beavers. Since I interviewed Elijah Portugal last spring about the adaptation plan he created for Walmart and the city of Logan so they could stop trapping and killing beavers, some new beaver pond infrastructure has gone in. I called Elijah up last weekend. He had just been out to visit the Walmart beaver pond that morning, and probably unrelated, he was feeling under the weather.
So do you want to describe what happened between, I guess, the last time we met at the Walmart pond, the beaver pond? It was April, and I think a lot has
right.
happened since then, and everything was kind of theoretical at that point. I remember you had your plan, the beaver management plan, and it was like a big paper packet, and it was all drawings and things that were not real. have some real things happened since April?
Yeah, they have. We've been able to carry out pretty much all the plans that we outlined in that broader document that we were looking at back in April. I was out there this morning And the pond levelers are functional. The water height in the ponds behind the dams haven't increased at all since we initially set that height with the pond levelers. And beaver have actually been active around one of the pond levelers and one of the dams. They've added some material to the dam crest, but haven't actually elevated the water surface elevation in the pond behind the dam crest because the pond leveler's doing its job.
And so, the pond leveler is underwater, right? So even if they build it up higher, the water is still going out underneath the dam.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically how they work. Basically, it's just a big flexible pipe, and you have your inlet to the pipe within the pond itself, so upstream of the dam. And then we build a wire mesh cage around that inlet to prevent too much mud or rocks or whatever from getting into that pipe opening. So beaver can continue to extend the height of the dam crest without actually being able to pond any more water up.
So they probably don't even really notice that it's there. I mean, they might be sort of scratching their heads, like, how come our pond isn't getting deeper even though we're building our... I don't know if they're that cognitively aware, but...
They very well could be thinking that. Yeah, it's hard to say how they perceive these pond levelers. It seems like they basically just ignore them.
And so if the ponds are going to flood, I'm guessing, is that like a spring runoff thing? Is that what we're kind of waiting for, the big test?
So, yeah, that's when they really are going to need to be doing their job as efficiently as possible. You know, spring runoff, the timing of that is dependent on what the weather is doing in the spring. But, you know, typically in May, April, May, you're going to be starting to get more water moving down that stream. And so that'll be the big test. And it looks like with the snow that we've been getting so far this winter that it actually might be a pretty good runoff pulse that we get this spring.
I know that this specific project probably got the most attention because it was in a pretty high traffic area. Are you doing other projects in other parts of the state that are sort of similar?
Yeah, so we've got all kinds of different projects going on related to beaver. As far as projects directly related to what we call living with beaver strategies, so like the pond level that we did at Walmart, we have been working on this development of a similar adaptive beaver management plan for Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. They have the Hardware Ranch Wildlife Refuge up Blacksmith Fork here in the south end of Cache Valley. And anyway, they have beaver in there, and they actually installed a pond leveler at our recommendation a couple years ago. Park City has put in a pond leveler based on our recommendations and based on a plan that my boss, Joe Wheaton, developed as kind of a more involved version of what we did for Walmart. In general, you know, we're interested in the role that beaver play in riverine ecosystems. You know, we believe, you know, the science supports this, that beaver are really keystone species, and they have this profound influence on a host of physical processes within the stream. So these living with beaver strategies, like the Walmart project, and then other types of river restoration projects where we support beaver dam building activities to try and, you know, garner the ecological and physical benefits from their dam building. And yeah, we've got a bunch of different projects going on.
Awesome. Well, keep up the good work. And thanks for the update. It's really nice to hear that that project's going well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're happy with how things have turned out.
That was Elijah Portugal with an update on his efforts to keep the Walmart parking lot from flooding so the beavers can stay where they've been for thousands of years. Ross, I hate going to Walmart. It's not my favorite place on earth. But every time I have to go, I go and I park in the far corner and I go visit the beaver, and there's always, you know, red-winged blackbirds chirping, and I see, you know, great blue heron. There's a Virginia rail that lives there, which is a pretty rare bird in Logan. And there's just, I mean, it's a corner of the parking lot. It's probably like the size of 10 parking spots. but it got left there when the parking lot went in because it's really an important
part of the system there. And so it's this really enjoyable little wetland. And I think it's, I mean, that was one of the more surprising stories that I came across.
Yeah, and I love that story too, because it's just another example of that nature is always, can be found in the most unexpected places. And you don't have to necessarily go to a national park to see nature. You can go to your local Walmart.
Go to Walmart. So if you're in Logan and you go to the South Walmart, park in the far southwest corner and go see what the beaver are up to. There are quite a few that live there. They're probably hibernating right now, but they'll be there.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Last August, Ross and I made a program called The Far Reaches of Utah Water that explored how Utah water research was being used outside of Utah, in other states and other countries. Producer Ryan Cunningham took it a step further and reported on Utah's relationship to the search for water on Mars. He probably has the biggest update of the year in water news.
This all started for me when I was thinking about how to live on Mars. Don't get me wrong, Utah's not bad, but sometimes I wish I was about 200 million miles away from the inversion. So I called around, and as it turned out, I wasn't the only person in Utah wondering what it would be like to live on Mars. In fact, right now, at this very moment, there's a team of researchers holed up in a tiny space yurt in the San Rafael Swell, officially referred to as the Mars Desert Research Station, or MDRS. At this faux Mars settlement in the middle of the Utah desert, various research teams study a wide array of logistical challenges that real astronauts could face on the actual Mars. So naturally, I called up one of these would-be Martian explorers for some insight. Engineer Nick Orenstein is an MDRS veteran.
So I treated it like method acting, where I convinced myself for a few days I was on Mars. And it was pretty fun, but also really interesting and informative to give people the psychological experience.
Nick's crew suffered a pretty big mishap in the station's greenhouse.
I looked out the window, and there was a huge flame of fire, like 10 or 15 feet tall, coming from the greenhouse outside. And that is the last thing you expect to see on a day on Mars, is a huge fire.
A quick side note, the Mars Society was able to raise enough money last year to repair the MDRS greenhouse. But back to the fire. To put it out, Nick told me the crew had to use a lot of their water supply. And that got me thinking about how to get water on Mars in the first place. You could deliver water from Earth, we've got plenty of it. But the problem is,
I don't think that you could rely on Earth to keep sending supplies and equipment, including water.
Because it's not very practical to deliver cargo to a distant planet, especially something as heavy as water. But I wasn't ready to give up on my Martian dreams yet, so I sought consolation from NASA scientist Melissa Rice. Melissa's been working with the Mars Curiosity rover to study the red planet's unique geology. She told me there's a chance there might be enough water waiting for us on the Martian surface.
There is water on Mars. There is just not very much of it compared with the amount of water we have on the Earth and other places in the solar system. And there's no liquid water at the surface of Mars, which is the other big difference. Most of the water is present in the atmosphere as water vapor or in the surface and in the rocks as water ice or as water that is wrapped up in mineral structures.
Oh, if only Mars had liquid water. Wouldn't that just be fascinating?
Good morning. Welcome to NASA headquarters in Washington. My name is Dwayne Brown with the Office of Communications. Ladies and gentlemen, the journey to Mars just got a whole lot more fascinating.
I kid you not, folks. A month after I talked to Melissa, NASA's Director of Planetary Science, Dr. Jim Green, had some pretty exciting news.
Today, we're revolutionizing our understanding of this planet. Our rovers are finding that there's a lot more humidity in the air than we ever imagined. As we ingest the soils, they're moist, they're hydrated, full of water. These discoveries are very important, but they were only part of the hydrological cycle on Mars that we're just now beginning to understand. What we're going to announce today is that Mars is not the dry, arid planet that we thought of in the past. Today we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
Is it fair of me to wonder if Melissa Rice had a hunch about these findings when I interviewed her in August? Maybe. But is it also fair of me to assume that maybe NASA didn't want a freelance public radio reporter to break the news of one of the biggest scientific discoveries in the history of our solar system? Yeah, I think so. But what matters is we have more reason than ever to go to Mars. If you're a planetary geologist like Melissa, you might be interested in studying the planet's potentially soggy soil. Or if you're Nick Orenstein, you might just be looking for a tall, refreshing glass of water.
I can't wait to drink a glass that didn't come from Earth. Yeah, so that's what I'm working for, that cold glass of water.
As for me, well, it'd just be nice to get away from this Utah inversion. For The Source, I'm Ryan Cunningham. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it. Let the children use it. Let all the children do get. You're listening to the final episode of The Source. We'll be right back.